Welcome to Triple Take, the podcast where we discuss the albums, books, and films that shape us. I'm Carla Jean Whitley.
I'm John Hammetry.
I'm Matt Scalise.
And today it is Matt's turn in the hot seat. We're just going to cut straight to the chase. Matt, tell us what your picks are.
My picks for my book, I chose The Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis. For my album, I chose Hunky Dory by David Bowie. And for my film, I picked Modern Times, a great movie by Charlie Chaplin.
I think this is going to be fun.
I think so. I mean, I'm not that interesting of a person, but I feel like I spend a lot of time carefully curating the pop culture that I consume, so hopefully we'll at least have some good stuff to talk about. I actually did not ever watch Chaplin movies until very recently, so I think all my picks are actually things I didn't come into contact with until I was well into my 20s. So these are all recent picks, really.
All right, well, let's get right into it. The three things you've picked all predate your existence.
Well, I think that's probably in character for me. Yeah. I have always been, I think, drawn to the old. You know, I am definitely somebody who's since I first dug into my own preferences and decided, like, these are the things that I'm going to decide I like, and I have my own opinions on things. I have always picked stuff that was probably older than me and before my time. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's on purpose or a conscious thing or if it's just the way stuff worked out. But, you know, I definitely feel like in the case of this book, you know, there's some things about it that feel dated. But in a way, I think that's what some of those things, I think in a way, make it more likable to me. I think it's sort of unafraid of approaching a subject that could seem very judgmental. And it does it in a way that's funny and fun and still doesn't really shy away from saying, hey, there's a black and a white and there's a right and a wrong. And, you know, again, those are things that can be very delicate to touch on. And I'm certainly trying to be conscious of that in my daily life when I'm talking about what I think is right and wrong, because I understand that my opinion isn't shared by everyone. Mm-hmm. But I feel like what's so cool about what C.S. Lewis did in this book is it's a discussion of morality, and it does it in a very non-judgmental way, because the character, it's all told from the viewpoint of an unabashed villain. Like, there's no one who's going to read this book and disagree and say, you know, I really think that this guy's actually okay. I mean, he basically says from the outset, I'm a demon, and my job is to get people to hell in whatever way that I can. And here's some of the tricks that I use to do it. And he's actually doing it by writing a letter to his demon nephew and trying to give him tips on how to successfully damn a soul.
Yeah, guiding up the younger generation.
Yeah, and so I think what's fascinating about what he did is it's not so much him just picking out things saying, this is a sin, this is wrong, people who do this are bad people. It's more about the processes that slowly lead people to making bad decisions and bad choices, and how really it certainly personifies evil, but I think the way that it approaches this is to say, really all people are good, and when they end up doing the wrong thing, it's because they started out trying to do something that was right and natural for everyone to do, and that there are all these things kind of set up to take advantage of us and to pull us into doing the wrong thing. And I think that's a really interesting way to look at it. I don't know that today that I look at evil as a sort of personified thing that's actively trying to get us, but it is a really, I think, effective image when you're reading it, to look at things that way, to look at kind of the path to evil as this thing that is kind of insidious, and the the scariest thing about it is that it goes after people who are trying to do the right thing. It doesn't always look like a Nazi. It's often just that you started out trying to do what feels right, and there was something waiting there to redirect you and take advantage of that.
And I think it's difficult to read the Screwtape letters without looking at your own life and examining what's going on with you or what may have in the past. So tell me about your experience when you first read this book and how that affected you.
Well, I probably read this in my mid-20s. So I had, in some ways, you know, it hit me at a time when I was, you know, trying to figure out who I was still. But I was, you know, certainly married already, probably already had a kid and was starting a family. But, you know, as I revisit it, I've been through a lot of things. Certainly all the most difficult things that have happened to me in my life have happened since I read this book, since my mid-20s. And I'm sure that this kind of outlook that this book gives you has had an effect on the way that I approach a lot of that stuff. You know, I've without going too much into it, I've certainly had a lot of health struggles. I've lost family members since then. And those are exactly the kinds of things that are talked about in this book is, you know, the way that you get it. One of the ways that he would certainly suggest that you get an otherwise good person to turn bad is you take away good things from them, and you take away things that they took for granted as just being a good part of life. And, you know, it does take... I'm not sure that I totally viewed life this way. I don't really see this kind of like active personified force of evil trying to hurt me, mm-hmm. but I do think it sometimes can help when you look at things as though it takes work to keep being a good person, mm-hmm. Because the natural way things play out is going to keep challenging you and keep trying to redirect you mm-hmm. away from good things and away from being a positive person. So you have to, in a way, you have to kind of keep going out there and fighting to be a positive person every day. And it can kind of help to create this image in your mind of a bad guy out there who's trying to make it go the other way for you.
Right. I think that in my view, the thing that this personification accomplishes, besides making for a really enjoyable read.
Right. It's also really funny, which is what's weird.
Yeah. I mean, like, he could have written this as more of a sort of self-help spiritual guide, mm-hmm. which it certainly is, but that could have been really dry. But the personification of evil, of a demon working to poke holes in your life, I think, can help bring attention to the nuance that we face every day and how we respond to what may seem like a small circumstance, a small moment of pride, for example, mm-hmm. could be an opportunity for Screwtape or Wormwood to get their hooks into you.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things, one of the more interesting approaches that he suggests in this book is sometimes the worst thing that can happen to someone is for them to get what they want and mm-hmm. for something good to happen to them. Because, again, it's not always just what you do and what you're striving towards. It's why you do it. And it's the intentions in your heart behind what you're doing. It matters, and it will eventually affect you if you don't have the right reasons to be doing what you're doing. And I think that's one of the most fascinating parts. And I don't know if your version has this, but mm-hmm. the version that I have mm-hmm. has a little extra thing that he wrote later. Yeah. Which is a toast that he mm-hmm. gives. And it's kind of a neat little add-on because it's really mm-hmm. more about how education and school is kind of where this all starts and how mm-hmm. that's their best opportunity to screw you up, basically. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of this is particularly timely today. At least it feels that way for me. That, you know, I find myself so often looking at things going on around me and saying, you know what, these are good people, and I truly believe that they think they're doing the right thing, but I think they've been misled, and I think that if something doesn't change, they will be pulled further and further down a path to not having good intentions anymore. So this is a book that, while, as you mentioned, it's very old, it is totally relevant today. And I think it still hits me, you know, it's remarkably perceptive about how people work and how they end up becoming something that they didn't ever want to be.
So let's talk about Hunky Dory, which I think is as far from the Screwtape Letters as you can get.
Is it?
I don't know, maybe not. Let's dive into it.
Yeah.
So when did you first listen to this seminal David Bowie album?
So I really did not, I'm not totally sure how I came upon this album, because I didn't really ever get that into David Bowie. It's not like I sort of had some phase where I was super into David Bowie. But at some point, you know what? I actually may have come into this album because of Paul Williams, who I became kind of a big fan of just from, there was a documentary about him a few years ago. And I knew certainly a lot of his songs that he had written for a number of different artists in the 60s and 70s. He's a great songwriter. And he wrote, I believe, at least one song on this album. I know he wrote Fill Your Heart. I'm not sure if he did any other ones. But, you know, I think that's probably what brought me to this album. And then as I listened to it, just start to finish all the way through, firstly, I think it has a lot of David Bowie's most lasting and powerful songs that have kind of, you know, I think there's a couple on here that if you ask the random person off the street to name a single David Bowie song, there's a very good chance they would pick a song from this album. But that said, it doesn't really feel like one of those albums that's just a bunch of pop hits. And I certainly don't think he set out to do that. It's a very cohesive album, and it feels, while it has a little bit of everything that he does, it has a little bit of that kind of glam rock to it. It has a little bit of singer-songwritery stuff.
Got a Bob Dylan tribute.
Yeah, but to me, out of all of the stuff that you hear from David Bowie, this is the one that feels kind of the smallest and most personal in a way, and it feels very folksy and singer-songwritery for a David Bowie album. It still has huge production on it, but you know, there's several songs in here that I just think this isn't what you think of as this like big makeup wearing glam rocker. A lot of these songs feel very small and sincere and personal.
But he does sort of get some of that sexual ambiguity and like campiness into the album.
Definitely.
Especially early on, you know, Life on Mars. And then also Changes is just a phenomenal, maybe the best Bowie song out there.
Yeah, Changes is an excellent, I mean, I think the first kind of half of the album to me is the one that I end up replaying the most. I mean, Changes is probably one of his more straightforward songs that you can just take on face value, but Oh You Pretty Things is a really great, like, to me that's like kind of a quintessential David Bowie song, because it's telling a little bit of a story, but the story is basically like all the grown-ups got freaked out because all the kids are taken over. They're you know, all of this stuff that terrifies them about the younger generation is taking over, and there's nothing they can do about it, and they're scared of you, and they're going to be really angry. And to me, that's kind of like the perfect summation of David Bowie and what he represented to a lot of people. Was firstly, he did freak out the older generations, and they didn't know what to do with them. And that's certainly what he was doing on purpose. But also, I think it gave people who'd felt weird and ostracized this kind of sense that I'm not the only one here. And I'm actually on the ascendancy. There's going to be more of me than there are of the other people soon.
Is that ever a way that you felt?
I don't know that I felt that way when I was a teenager, but I think when I got to this album when I was in my 20s, I did feel more that way. I started to feel more like I was an other, and that I was sort of apart from what most other people were. And I think mostly I just had a delayed teenage. Sure. I think I was a very straight-laced teenager. I did not do anything to get in trouble. I was a good kid. I didn't really ever have a bad relationship with my parents or fight with them. I think it all kind of hit me later, and I don't entirely know why. It could be because, you know, I just decided not to do that when I was a teenager. It could be because I met different people. I got married to a woman who did not allow me to say stupid things and get away with it. You know, if I said something dumb, she would say, "Hey, that's a really bad opinion. I think you should probably rethink that." So I think that's when I really started to probably do what a lot of kids do when they're 17 and 18, which is to say, like, "Oh man, like nobody gets me. I'm different than everybody else."
Right. But I did start questioning your parents.
Mid-20s. And so, you know, the other thing too that this album does is, I think it has some aesthetic qualities to it that really hit me very hard, and I can't explain why. And Life on Mars is probably the best example of it, because it's been pointed out to me that song lyrically does not mean anything. It's gibberish. It's complete nonsense.
Yeah.
And yet everybody that has heard, I mean, there's that's probably his song that is most karaoke'd, I would bet. It's like everybody knows the song. They feel like they can sing every word and it means something to them, but it doesn't actually, it's not coming from the text. There's something about that song that makes everybody feel like they have a huge emotional attachment to it, right, even though they've brought that to it, I think.
It's the Smells Like Teen Spirit effect, where he's just saying things and you're feeling them because of yeah, who you are listening to it.
Right. It's amazing. I mean, it's an 8-line poem, which is right before it on the album, is another one that it's literally just a poem about his cat in his apartment. And for some reason, when you listen to it, it stirs such emotion and makes you think, this has got to mean something, man. Like, he's really feeling this deeply. But the actual lyrics, it's just describing things around him in his apartment. And I think he has some ability with his vocals and with his songwriting to tap into emotions. And he doesn't have to tell you what to feel. It's going to happen. He's pulling that out of you with his guitar chords and with his you know, sort of vocal mastery. So I just think that's a really cool magic trick that he pulls off with this album. Mm-hmm. All right, since I am usually handling the movie portion of this podcast, we brought in a colleague of ours and a good friend of mine, Ben Flanagan, to take over this portion of the show while I'm in the guest seat. So Ben will be asking all of the movie questions, and Ben knows a lot more about movies than I do. He's Ben and I go way back as movie arguers, movie discussers with one another.
Definitely true, Matt, and thanks for having me here on this podcast, of which I am a fan. And since the tables are turned, Matt, just sit back and relax, keep your mouth shut for the next few minutes, and I'll take over here. And you're right, I do know way more about movies than you do, but unfortunately, it's not a place for me to share my movie knowledge. We're here to share your movie knowledge, mm-hmm, and talk about a movie that is one of your favorites, if not your favorite. Perhaps it is one day, and perhaps it's not the next. And coincidentally, Matt, you and I have been a part of a podcast called Film Nerds Unlimited, where not too long ago we talked about our top three favorite movies of all time, and you listed three films that are not the movie we're talking about today.
Dang, you researched this before you came.
You talked about The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, the great Sergio Leone spaghetti western classic. Mm-hmm. You talked about Back to the Future, which I think was number one. Remind me of what number two was.
I don't know. I probably would have said Goodfellas.
No,
maybe?
I'm sorry. I was mistaken. So number three was Crimes and Misdemeanors. Yes. Number two was Good, the Bad, okay, and the Ugly. Number one was Back to the Future. None of these were the movie we're here to talk about today. And yeah, as a big movie fan, I know that day to day, your favorite movie changes, mm-hmm. or at least your top 10 list of all time, favorite movie, book, album, whatever, it changes. Today, we're not necessarily going to talk about your favorite movie, but the movie that was just such a seminal piece of your life that sort of shaped your way of thinking, it's Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times. And having been a longtime friend of yours, I've known that Charlie Chaplin has been a really important part of your life as a moviegoer and somebody who just really loves the arts in general. So why now do you pick a movie from 1936 in Modern Times from the great Charlie Chaplin?
Well, I think I first got into Chaplin's movies because of your brother, Graham, who, again, pretty much as long as I have known the two of you, we've all been talking about movies with each other. It's kind of our common language, and we were working on a podcast series with each other, and Graham wanted to talk about all the Charlie Chaplin movies, and so I went and found a way to watch them all. And you know, this is the one I think that stuck with me more than any of them, because I mean, I think it speaks the most to what I see around me today and the sort of problems that we're all facing and the anxieties we're all facing, even though it's about a pre-World War II world. It's about the anxieties people had of being in this increasingly less sort of traditional pastoral America and moving more towards everybody working on an assembly line and people being treated more like, you know, inhuman machines rather than you know, these organic human beings. And it's a movie that's very funny, but it's about a very serious and distressing topic, and it's making light, I think, of it's doing what a lot of great comedians do, which is that it's taking something that's making us all incredibly anxious and worried in a kind of existential way, and it's giving us a chance to laugh at it because it's basically all you can do. And I feel like that, first of all, that those anxieties feel very real and present right now and have for a long time, I think. But I think what we're missing in a large part right now is somebody who's able to speak to everybody and try and humanize it and try and make it feel, you know, like something we can overcome. I don't know if it's just that the culture is so divided now, but you know, Chaplin had an audience that there's nothing close to it. Nobody today alive really is as famous as Chaplin was when he made this movie. And you know, he had a very important message for the world about how we need to treat each other in as the world continues to change. And I think it's a message that absolutely still works today. It's just that some of the specific kind of analogies maybe don't fit, but I really think you could probably show this to kids and they'd still have a pretty, they wouldn't need much explained to them in this movie.
Yeah, it's interesting because of the sort of physical nature of Chaplin as a storyteller, the nonverbal storytelling that made his contribution to the medium so crucial and what made him such a great innovator, along with people like Buster Keaton and other silent film stars and silent film directors. And what was interesting about Modern Times is it found Charlie Chaplin, who was great at this point, and everybody was a big fan, like you say, it found him at a personal and creative crossroads in that in 1936, plenty of movies were being made with diegetic sound.
Mm-hmm.
And he was about to make this his first official talkie movie, but in the end, he sort of opted to sort of stick to his silent guns and tell the movie with, albeit some differences in factoring in some of those sound innovations that had become so prominent in Hollywood, he decided to make the movie sort of traditionally in the silent mold. And I think you're right. I think that people of all ages will respond to this, because you see a movie like WALL-E from Pixar that came out a few years ago, which is primarily designed for kids. There's so much non-verbal storytelling happening in a way that I think people appropriately compared to the work of Charlie Chaplin. So what do you think makes silent film, particularly the work from Charlie Chaplin, so universal to where you can enjoy this with perhaps your kids?
Well, I mean, I think first of all, it's he's by the time he makes this movie, I think he has this whole thing figured out so well that you don't really even need title cards. You know, there are a few in the movie, but this is now he's elevated what he's doing to a point where he doesn't even have to stop and write it out for you and explain what's going on. He can communicate almost everything without the need for words. And I think that's the sign of great filmmaking. It's a visual medium, and you have to be able to tell the story visually more than anything else. If you're not telling the story visually, it doesn't matter what you're saying or what, you know. There are plenty of great movies where there's a ton of talking going on and a lot of great dialogue and acting, but there still has to be visual communication going on, and he's the master of it in this. But I think also, even playing with sound as he does in this movie, it's almost like he's kind of making fun of its importance, because the only time he actually speaks in this movie with his own voice, and the first time he ever spoke on film actually, is a song in this movie, and it's complete gibberish. He made up the language to sing it in. So he's kind of saying, like, I can do stuff with my voice and it's still funny and it works, but it doesn't actually matter what I'm saying. I can do it whether you understand the word I'm saying or not. And I think great filmmakers today understand that you have to make it work first visually. And kids movies are a great place for that to happen, because kids don't really, they're not receiving your dialogue first anyway. They can understand from watching interactions between characters a lot better than they can watching them talk to each other. I mean, that's how kids perceive everything anyway.
Have you shown any Chaplin or Modern Times specifically to your kids yet?
I did not show Modern Times to them. I think I have watched a couple of shorts with my daughter before, and you know, she's definitely, I think, interested in it and open to it. The longer features would probably take a little bit longer for me to get into it with them, but you know, I think they definitely have an appreciation for older movies, and it doesn't really make that much of a difference to them what era it's from. It's more about, you know, the way that the movie plays out. We watched Wizard of Oz last night, and it was like they were watching a brand new movie. I mean, it all works for them. There's parts that really scare them. There's parts that make them laugh. And it's, you know, I think that if you pick the right movies for your kids, it's the stuff that's held up over time tends to be the stuff that has visuals that really stick with you.
Well, and you talked about sort of how there are parallels in terms of this movie's themes compared to sort of the world and specifically the country in which we mm-hmm. live today. Obviously, this movie is about how you respond to adversity in sort of an age of uncertain future. And given the United States is currently, after an election, in the midst of its own transition and an uncertain future with a new leader, do you watch this movie through that prism now? Do you think about it through that prism now, just in terms of the themes that Charlie Chaplin is exploring about his own country, and that he made this movie during the midst of a depression and there was an uncertain future for America back then, and now you find all sorts of parallels, but does the movie just simply entertain you? Does it speak to you more as a film lover and somebody who can enjoy everything that it brings without having to think about the more in-depth thematic elements that Charlie Chaplin is exploring? Or as you think about it now in the age that you live, is that how you're sort of absorbing Modern Times?
Well, I think this movie more than any of his other movies just works as a piece of entertainment, because there's these incredible action, I guess you call them action comedy set pieces, that just took, they're both amazing stunts that he's doing and just incredibly inventive with how they design the sets and everything about them and the way they fold into the story. So it works completely as just a piece of incredible physical comedy and storytelling. But yeah, I think the thing that makes this movie stick with me is, you know, I think about a lot of Chaplin movies. This guy was probably better than anybody else, still maybe an all-timer, at closing out a movie, at how you finish the movie. His last shots, last scenes are perfect very, very frequently. And this one has an incredibly important and resonant last shot that really sticks with you and leaves you with this very specific feeling and sentiment of hope in the face of, you know, everything else kind of going to crap. And I would say this one, along with The Great Dictator, another Chaplin movie, they both really made a huge impact on me when I saw them, I guess about 10 years ago at this point. And I think in some ways, even though I probably was a little less anxious about the country back then, I think they've just become even more relevant and important. And they both have great, great hopeful messages, despite the fact that they take place in a world where terrible things are happening. And I think everybody, if you're concerned about the future of the country or just the direction everything seems to be heading, I would highly encourage you to go watch Modern Times or The Great Dictator, because they are movies that will acknowledge your fears and anxieties, but they will also give you a reason to be hopeful about things.
My last question for you here, Matt, is Chaplin is probably, even though he has an amazing filmography with a litany of short films and other movies, and you mentioned The Great Dictator there, but I think he's probably best known for sort of a big three from his mm-hmm. silent era of filmmaking, and that's Modern Times and City Lights and The Gold Rush. Mm-hmm. These are movies that were first introduced to me growing up back when like AFI released their top 100 movies of all time.
Yeah.
And all these Chaplin movies pop up, and I'm in middle school or high school when that list comes out, and I'm unfamiliar with the silent stuff, and it took me a while to get there, and I'm wondering, why are these silent movies on there? You know, why aren't these movies that I grew up with on there? But out of those three, mm-hmm. why does Modern Times stick out among the rest?
Well, it is the chronologically the last one of the three that he made. That may not be a coincidence. I mean, I think it feels in a lot of ways like it's more developed, and like he's a little bit more of a developed filmmaker when you're watching it. You know, it's bigger and more ambitious than the other two, I think, in a lot of ways. And the first two, you know, The Gold Rush and City Lights are very, they're very sweet, sentimental movies that have, you know, these moments where the most memorable moments from those movies are these moments where it's just Chaplin being a super, super lovable character. And I think Modern Times probably jumps out to me more than the other two because he's playing the same character from the first two movies, but he's now kind of in a world where he doesn't belong anymore. And it creates this very sympathetic situation for me as a viewer watching this guy who was made for a different time and a different world than he's in try to struggle through it. And, you know, he's doing the best he can. He's trying to make the right decisions, but it's like he just doesn't really fit where he is. And he's trying to make a go of it anyway. There's something very admirable to me about that, and very makes that character even more sympathetic. That, you know, he was always kind of a bum. He was always a tramp, but now the world is even more hostile to him, and he's still just doing his thing. He's still just trying to be the same guy.
This has been Flanagan with Alabama Media Group and AL.com. You can find me on Twitter at This Ben Flanagan. I'm also a part of other movie podcasts like Film Nerds Unlimited and Aspect Radio. And for AL.com, you can find some other podcasts I think you might enjoy about Alabama entertainment and even professional wrestling if you're into that. And those are Ram It Jam It and Rammer Slammer. So check them out.
I'm John Hammontree. You can find me on Twitter at John Hammontree.
I'm Matt Scalise. You can find me on social media at Matt Scalise.
I'm Carla Jean Whitley, and you can find me all over social stuff at Inkstained Life.
And y'all be sure to download us on iTunes and give us a rating. Thanks.